to my exuberant family and friends near and far, old and new. This is Kevin Mercurio on the mic, and welcome to the 24th episode of the Metaphorigens podcast. Now, to show support if you like this sort of content, please make sure to rate and subscribe to the podcast on Apple or Spotify or Google Podcasts or whatever platform you're listening to this on, and follow at Metaphorigens on Instagram. That's at Metaphorigens, where I'll be posting most of my updates as well as on my personal website, kjbmercurio.com/Metaphorigens. Note that I will hold another draw on my 30th episode for the magical butterfly-printed custom Metaphorigen shirt, so do follow the Instagram page to be placed into the draw. Okay, so for today's episode, I'm going to discuss an expression you've probably heard countless times, whether you observe some unwarranted misfortune or whether you were the one the misfortune was brought. Let's get the story rolling. You are a mean, marauding milking machine. You heard me. You run one of the most prominent dairy farms in Canada, with the majority of them in central province Quebec, just outside of the Quebec City capital. In fact, almost all of the milk in Quebec is produced in your farms, representing more than a third of Canada's total milk. It's a booming business. And booming it has been. In an effort to rid the country of bone diseases prominent in children, such as rickets and osteomalacia, Canada followed the America's already implemented fortification of milk with vitamin D. This vitamin, known by most to be synthesized under the skin when exposed to UVB light from the sun through the formation of the intermediate compound cholecalciferol, increases the absorption of calcium and in turn can strengthen bone density. Advertising and lobbying by the dairy industry has supplanted the very honest idea that drinking milk builds strong bones, particularly in children. Now, combine that with the increase in delicious, sugary breakfast cereals, and you have the ingredients of a thriving empire. That's exactly what you did. You were a driven early entrepreneur in the milk game, a game not meant for the weak. Not only did your company embrace communicating the science behind milk's contribution to human vitality, but it made significant partnerships with the leading cereal brands. These were Larry the Lion's Toasty Tarts, Sam and Tom's Veggie Hoops, and the beloved Count Caramella. You even started an advertising campaign for addressing which group did customers fall under, cereal then milk, or milk then cereal. Consumers loved it. However, towards the early 2000s, consumer mindsets began to change. People wanted plant-based alternatives. Hidden cameras on your farms captured scathing evidence of cow mistreatment. For public relation purposes, you distance away from these bad actors. More companies joined the game, increasing the pool of milk types. Your company already provided the majority of whole milk, skim milk, and low-fat milk, but they were all cow's milk. Soon, these were all joined on store shelves by oat milk, soy milk, and almond milk. These weren't milk products, they were hacks, providing seemingly healthier alternatives while pretending that this betters the environment. Your business suffers, crumbling to your lowest profits in decades. You needed a new product, a way to get consumers back on Team Cow, on Team Real Milk. Perhaps a new ingredient needed to be added, something so simple that it had not been thought about yet due to its availability. Something so obvious, like chocolate milk, that it just clicks in all the right places. It can't be sugar, because milk products are already added to sweet cereals or serve as dipping pools for cookies. But what about salt? Yes, that's gotta be it. You walk towards your multi-million dollar kitchen, pour yourself a glass of smooth milk, and grab your salt shaker. First, just a few shakes. Take a sip. Interesting flavor. Perhaps a few more shakes. And there it was. The first rendition of what your company would later call Say Milk, a combination of the words saline and milk. It was an instant hit. Bottles and bottles of Say Milk were hoarded off shelves. You see, milk was always directed towards the sweet tooth of the youth, and milk was often neglected in drawing consumers from the older crowd. This was due to both taste, lactose intolerance, and meal regimens of adults. But what is the Achilles heel of the adult palate? Savory, sweet and salty. It was obvious. After a successful fiscal year, you visit your biggest manufacturing plant for Saymilk. It's a colossal area the size of a small rural Canadian town, where both the raising of cows and packaging of new milk products takes place. It was the innovation of a lifetime in the dairy industry. You notice something peculiar about one of the workers at this particular plant. The person would continuously stop, adjust their glasses while standing to gaze at the equipment. You walk up to the person. "What are you doing?" you ask. "What do you mean?" Before turning to face you, they take off their glasses and slide them into their front pocket. "You know, it's odd. I don't recall seeing you during the initial phases of this plant, in which I interviewed and hired everyone working here."
"I'm new,"
the person says. "May I see your glasses?" Suddenly, upon asking this question, the person pushes you to the side and runs to the upstairs control facility. Locking the door behind them, they start pressing buttons all across the control board. Machines began pumping milk into containers that were not under the nozzle, wasting product. Then, a loud alarm sounded. The pressure of the milk vat prior to the saline addition step was on overload. Its side burst, cracking one of its leg supports, toppling the monstrous vat over and spilling milk all across the factory floor. A whole year's batch of this product, gone, almost instantaneously. This would seriously hurt keeping up with demand for such a new dairy product. Competitors would surely take advantage of the low supply, spiking the products to increase their shelf space. All you've worked for, gone, due to some animal rights activist, investigative journalist, or some hired crony. You drop to your knees and start weeping. The perpetrator, handcuffed by security personnel and escorted out of the control room, looks to you and says, "Serves you right. Cows should not be treated so inhumanely. It's no use crying over spilled milk." At that moment, you're crushed. Weighted shoulders topple you over, face first into the spilled milk, tears running down your face. You open your mouth and taste the spilled milk. Oddly, your tears gave it that salty, say milk taste you and your customers love. It reminded you of that day in your kitchen with your salt shaker only a year ago, discovering something new, discovering something that you truly believed in. The activist was right, in a way. Crying never solves anything. So you get back up and go back to work. Okay, you mean, marauding milking machine, let's tone back to the real world. This expression is likely heard from both the giving and receiving end, often in the hopes of finding that motivation to get to working at solving the problem at hand. But when did tearful sadness over this beverage become our collective turning point? What is the origin to the expression, "It's no use crying over spilled milk"? Most of this information was obtained from various articles discussing the different origins to this expression. All sources we mentioned in the description. How many of us these days have an inkling feeling that something is wrong? A lost sense of where one goes from here, or an inability to imagine the near future? Due to the pandemic, so many people have experienced loss, whether that be through employment or worse. Loss of a loved one, a family member, a friend, or neighbor. It's almost like it's been forever since the number one issue taking a large piece of the attention pie was not the potential contraction of COVID-19. Like many of us, perhaps if you were feeling this way, you've sought consultation from relatives or trained professionals. Perhaps you yourself have been asked for advice regarding someone's situation, someone who trusts you to guide them or show them some light in a dark tunnel. Tears in their eyes, what do you say that can motivate them to push forward and give them the energy they obviously seek in order to live their best life? These sorts of circumstances are exactly when today's expression is typically utilized, often by advice givers who either lack empathy or believe the duration of this inkling feeling is anything but ephemeral. Imagine hearing or telling a person in terrible times it's no use crying over spilled milk, equating whatever is currently happening in their life to toppling a beverage. You can argue that the pandemic was probably not a great example, though I struggled to form a relevant one that could affect all those listening, and that in more mundane scenarios this expression would work. But even that's subjective. Maybe a breakup does require some crying and reminiscence. Surprisingly, Obama used this expression in a joke during his 2012 State of the Union address, quote, "I've ordered every federal agency to eliminate rules that don't make sense. We got rid of one rule from 40 years ago that could have forced some dairy farmers to spend $10,000 a year proving that they could contain a spill, because milk was somehow classified as an oil. With a rule like that, I guess it was worth crying over spilled milk." One thing's for sure, this expression always comes as advice after a loss. Lexico.com states that it's no use crying over spilled milk means, quote, "There is no point in regretting something which has already happened and cannot be changed or reversed." I like this expression because, well, at least in my experience and through witnessing it being said to others firsthand, it usually comes only after the first time this advice-seeking plea surfaces. Move on. You know, when life gives you lemons, make lemonade. Even me, I often come to the automatic notion that whether I am being asked for advice or that I'm the one seeking advice, that the answer is to get over difficult situations as quickly as possible. Why is that? Why, after so many years of evolutionary carnage, that we fail to attain the ability to be uncomfortable and reflect? Summed up by Matt Bomer's character in The Sinner, when being given ways to get over losing his friend in a car accident, quote, "Move on." Why does everyone say that? I'm sorry, I mean, it's like the only thing that matters is getting over things as fast as you can. I'm probably missing the optimist's perspective of this expression. Often this expression helps frame an issue as something outside of one's control, and therefore one can only step forward into a new day. Funny enough, we recently just passed Don't Cry Over Spilled Milk Day on February 11th, highlighted by the US National Day Calendar and National Today, the latter containing a three-step quick start guide on what to do on that day. Number one, rejoice. Number two, start working on getting over something, by breathing apparently. And three, sing a happy song. Interestingly, Pharrell comes to mind almost instantaneously. Digging deeper, I become more aware at the connectedness of this expression. It takes on a whole new meaning when one literally cries over milk, not cow milk, but one's own milk. Galit Romanelli, founder of the Mother Milk platform, helps connect and empower women to share their feeding stories. Featured in an article on the At the Well project, Romanelli shares the hardship she faced when being, in her own eyes, inadequate at feeding her own baby. Quote, "The frustration and disappointment tangled up with exhaustion and physical pain left me feeling like I had already failed as a mother. Could you tell a mother that it's no use crying over the minute amount of milk you are able to provide for your child?" There's also research on spilled milk, literally. One study published in the Journal of Cognitive Development looked at the differences in how preschoolers felt when a human spilled their glass of milk compared to a puppy. Titled, quote, "When to Cry Over Spilled Milk, Young Children's Use of Category Information to Guide Inferences About Ambiguous Behavior," is an interesting read, with major findings stated, quote, "Children tended to be harsher judges of the same ambiguous behaviors when performed by humans as compared to animals, boys compared to girls, and older children compared to younger children." Okay, I have very much digressed here. Let's get to the purpose of this podcast, Who Done It First and Why. The Reluctant Gourmet and Ginger Software, I'm still in disbelief that they chose that as their name, suggests that its origin comes from fairy lore. Stated by the Reluctant Gourmet, quote, "The belief was that fairies enjoyed drinking spilled milk, so the loss of it was not a complete waste." Others lament timelines of when it appeared in literature. Writing explained, posed that it appeared in a book by George Ogilvy Preshaw titled Banking Under Difficulties, in which, after a man was robbed, says in almost unbelievable optimism, quote, "It was no use, however, crying over spilt milk. Spilt and spilled are used synonymously, but spilled has taken hold in Western cultures. Poem Analysis and Know Your Phrase go further into the past with an 1872 book, Once a Week, where it is stated, quote, a correspondent of the same paper who signs himself octogenarian raised the question of the date when, quote, there's no use crying over spilt milk first came into proverbial use. Grammarphobia also mentions its presence within Jonathan Swift's Polite Conversations, mentioned in this podcast already, in which he writes, quote, 'Tis a folly to cry for spilt milk. However, every source discussing the origin to It's No Use Crying Over Spilled Milk mentions its first account was found in James Howell's collection of English proverbs published in 1659, quote, no weeping for shed milk, making this expression at least 350 years old. Shed here meaning the accidental loss of something. Its presence there, unfortunately, means that the expression was likely commonly used even then. So therefore, it is unfortunate that we come to the end of the segment with the origin of It's No Use Crying Over Spilled Milk just out of reach. Perturbing questions I have for the originator remain, like, why milk? Who exactly cried over it being spilled? And more importantly, goddammit, why won't we as a society encourage the catharsis of expressing emotion for one's enlightenment? Before we get to the next segment, do you love listening to podcasts? If you're like myself, you may have contemplated even starting a podcast yourself. Let me tell you, as one of the many ways one can creatively express themselves, starting this podcast was one of the best decisions I have ever made. For one thing, it sort of gives you an excuse to learn about things you actually are interested in and understand it by speaking to an audience about it. For another, it has given me the opportunity to meet other podcasters and other science communicators who inspire me in their own creative endeavors. The problem in starting something new is that it may be difficult to know where to start. That's where Buzzsprout comes in. Buzzsprout is a seamless service that helps one launch a professional podcast with over 100,000 people supported on their platform. Your show can be online and listed in all the major podcast directories, like Apple Podcasts, Spotify, Google Podcasts, and more, within minutes of finishing your recording. Additionally, you get a sweet-looking podcast website, detailed analytics to support the growth of your show, by far the greatest feature, methods of promoting and marketing your show, the list goes on. And of course, the Buzzsprout community of experts and podcast hosts offers great tips via online forums, YouTube videos, and even quick podcast episodes themselves. To start your own podcast and get a $20 Amazon gift card you can use towards simple podcast equipment you may need, click the affiliate link in the episode's description. This lets Buzzsprout know that I sent you to their service and will help support MetaForigins in money towards creating more butterfly merch. Buzzsprout, the easiest way to start a podcast. And now, back to the episode. For my communication segment, I would like to talk about a career path not many of my peers consider when undertaking higher level education, an occupation that takes the more diverse soft skills you've obtained while in your specialization through a master's or PhD and applies it to the bigger picture. And that topic is consulting. Now, this may not seem like a communication topic, but it is. In fact, it tied so well with today's expression that I immediately knew that I had to do a segment about it. Not only are you communicating effectively throughout your entire workday in consulting, but becoming a consultant, developing interpersonal skills and interview skills are all tied into the gig. Perhaps some thoughts that may have accrued since I mentioned consulting. Sure, you've heard of it, but what exactly does it entail? It's such a general title for a job that it really has no meaning. You've consulted or given advice about many different things, whether that be in research or general life. What are they, like the therapists of failing businesses, fortune tellers to ventures in which much time and financial investment is staked on? Actually, kind of, yeah. Consultants are the experts' go-to for advice. They are the LeBron Jameses of basketball, the Katharine Hepburns of acting, or the Norm Macdonalds of comedy. That last one, not in regards to consulting, but a true quote by none other than David Letterman himself. And yes, consultants can be summoned in all shapes and sizes, with backgrounds in business like an MBA, or those who trained in niche fields at the higher level like through a master's, PhD, JD, MD, and even some good consultants with an undergraduate degree have achieved some success. The most important thing is that consulting provides another avenue for those who may have been eyeing some academic faculty position as their end goal after graduation, when in reality not only is the number of PhDs given out each year increasing, thus increasing your competition in the job market, the number of PhDs employed as tenured and tenured track faculty has declined. In the 2019 Science Mag article, quote, "For the first time in the U.S., private sector employment is now nearly on par with educational institutions regarding hiring those with PhDs, the latter also including postdoctoral researchers, research associate roles, lab managers, etc." Let's remain on academia for a brief moment. As mentioned in previous episodes, even this season, the environment of academia isn't really a thriving or accepting one. There's a power hierarchy, a prestige, that emanates from the most sought-after schools. There's the discriminatory aspect in that minorities are underrepresented at high-level positions like professorships, deans, or institute heads. Luckily, that is changing now, albeit very slowly. There's the way in which governments and academic institutes allocate funds through grant competitions that determine whether your projects are to be funded or not. And if it's not selected, what then? The struggle to publish literally anything in order to increase the major metric in evaluating your success. Forums of upcoming graduates and professors looking for alternatives while being afraid to provide any sort of identification for fear of being ousted. In other words, will there ever be a shift in the opinion that working in academia is a great thing, through word of mouth or even just looking through posts on your social media? Now, why consider consulting to begin with? Especially since you've been trained to specialize more and more, like your thesis topic and subtopics. Top reasons that come to mind: 1, structure; 2, fast-paced and impact-driven; 3, early deliverables; 4, talented team players; and 5, connection with industry. In a video from John Hopkins Medicine, trainees with upcoming consulting careers lined up discuss these reasons in more detail. Paraphrasing their advice, for 1, most projects are defined with set goals, usually asked for and honed by the clients consultants serve. For 2, most projects last a finite amount of time, definitely not longer than a few months, and thus you're switching between impact-driven projects quickly, which will hopefully lead to 3, early deliverables or achievements of the goals you and your client outlined. For 4, you are surrounded by bright individuals, just like you were in academic years, but with more generalists looking to change the world and have the means to do so through 5, connection with top industry players that have the capital to give the world what consumers demand of them, unfortunately, for better or for worse. In fact, as Ryan Bennett, head of the advanced degree candidate recruiting team of the renowned Boston Consulting Group, or BCG, in Chicago mentions, quote, "Candidates with a PhD have all the skills to be excellent consultants. Other firms many graduates or business-oriented professionals shoot for are McKinsey & Co., Bain, and Deloitte. These firms have a more broader scope in terms of the projects they are offered and the consultant backgrounds they are staffed with. However, as stated in another Science Mag article discussing management consulting, a complete guide to the industry by Sagata Biswas and Daryl Twitchell state that, quote, firms are segmented by the industries they serve, while boutique firms specialize in a particular industry or a small subset of industries. And more importantly, quote, entry-level consultants, including at the PhD level, tend to be hired by larger firms because they have the most resources available for training. For those in life sciences, as many of my peers are, perhaps you may be interested in more specialized consulting within firms like Clearview Healthcare, Navigant, ZS Associates, Putnam Associates, and Huron Consulting. Most PhDs wonder what are the skills required to jump from being a specialist to a generalist, and whether their projects have prepared them for this leap. Many testimonials of successful consultants have reassured that most PhDs do prepare you to be a professional consultant. One McKinsey consultant who finished a PhD in biochemical engineering stated that, quote, I often heard problem-solving skills developed through scientific research are the core skills of consulting, and I can't agree more. Soon, I became the product expert of the team, including being able to answer all of McKinsey partners' questions about the products. It was as exciting as the discussions I used to have with my PhD advisor. Another McKinsey consultant who completed a PhD in cancer immunology at University College London mentioned that, quote, running a PhD project is analogous to managing a small company, where you need to spot a gap in the market, something unique in your research area, plan a strategy to tackle the issue, mobilize resources, meet deadlines, manage expectations, and communicate clearly with your stakeholders, such as the PhD supervisor. I feel that overcoming the uncertainties and complexities of a PhD helped me build the strength and endurance to tackle and change in my life. Of course, it's not a complete program, as both testimonials mention a background or even basic knowledge of business terms and ideals is certainly an asset to be a productive team member of consulting firms. Mentioned in a Rooster Vane blog post for those looking to be an independent consultant, quote, okay, so you're launching a consultancy. Will it be a corporation, a partnership, or will you operate as a sole proprietor? Do your clients even hire sole proprietors, or do they require incorporation? How will you do your bookkeeping? Are you keeping track of your tax write-offs? Do you need insurance? Try reading some business books. Drop by a local small business support center or browse government websites dedicated to helping. Learn as much as you can. So let's say you're interested and dedicated to at least preparing your resume to tailor towards these sorts of positions. Note that there are many resources online that can help prepare you in advance. First, you gotta land consulting interviews, which are a monster on their own, kind of like medical school interviews. To start, you need a resume and cover letter that stand out, pretty basic. Then do a basic math and logic test, as interestingly, many PhDs struggle here since most are more used to complex mathematical problems through their research versus developing skills to complete simple arithmetic quickly, and then the first and second round interviews. Also note that, as mentioned in an article on I Got an Offer Consulting, quote, some recruiters have small prejudice against PhD students. They think they are good problem solvers, but lack soft skills. In your resume, you should therefore make an effort to show off your soft skills. Two easy ways to do this are to talk about the different collaborations you've worked on and the different presentations you made at conferences. But moving on, the interviews are something I will spend the last part of this segment talking about. These interviews can be broken up into fit interviews, whether you would be a great addition to their team, and case interviews, how fast you can think on your feet. As stated by the Hacking the Case Interview online resource, quote, case interviews begin with the interviewer reading you the background information on the case. You'll then get the chance to ask clarifying questions to better understand the business situation and the case objective. Next, you'll develop a framework to help you solve the case. A framework is a tool that helps you structure and break down complex problems into smaller, more manageable components. You'll then be asked to answer quantitative and qualitative questions to build support for a recommendation. You may need to calculate expected profitability, interpret charts and graphs, or brainstorm and prioritize different ideas. At the end of the case interview, the interviewer will then ask you to deliver a final recommendation to address or solve the business problem. These problems could be something like, how does Coca-Cola increase its profitability, or how should Apple price its new iPhone? In any case, it is unlikely to be related to your PhD work at all, but with your basic understanding of business, your excellent level of problem solving, and the more important fact that you've practiced online case examples many times, just like practice GRE, MCAT, or LSAT exams, these are usually pretty straightforward. And once you land a job, most projects are likely to be more tailored to the experience you actually have. Bottom line is, a lot of students, including myself, go into PhD programs with an outlook of some faculty position in an academic institution. Perhaps you will end up there. But what I find lacking in most colleges and universities is the push to highlight uncommon positions that the degrees we invest so much time and money into obtaining actually benefit us having. Through my own volunteer work when I was at the University of Ottawa organizing my faculty's career day, I was astonished at the diversity of careers available for myself and my peers, consulting being one of them. And what I found intriguing about consulting in particular is its effort to be connected to true impactors of the human experience. But most intriguing of all was the focus on making things simple and easy to understand, whether that be through acknowledging what your clients even do or explaining to clients the solutions you have thought about. That's truly the end goal of all higher level education, the skill of solving a complex problem and communicating the solution in a comprehensible way. I realize consultants, at least some, are just applied science communicators. For today's episode, I'll be interviewing someone who not only recently finished his PhD dissertation and grateful to have attended his defense and support, but went through the interview process and now works as a consultant for one of the top three consulting firms in America. He is a management consultant at McKinsey. Before joining the firm, he got his PhD in biomedical engineering from Duke University and his BEng in electrical engineering from Tsinghua University in Beijing. He likes lifting and playing tennis on weekends and enjoys reading books on a wide range of topics. He is very excited to chat about PhD life and the path to consulting today, so please welcome the incredibly smart Ziyi Wen. Thank you, Ziyi, for joining me on this podcast today. Again, it's a pleasure that you accepted to come on this episode about consulting. I know you're a consultant yourself who it's been a year, but the last time we communicated was when you defended, which was, I think, in March of last year. Is that correct?
Yes.
Okay, so it has been a while, almost a year. Great defense, by the way. I'm happy that you invited me to it. It kind of gave me a sort of window into how the PhD defense would look like.
I hope it was not too, like, complex or, you know, it was...
No, I don't think so. I found it interesting. I even had a chance to ask you a question at the end, which is something I didn't know they allowed people to do, so that was cool. And just to kind of get a... some information and context to the listeners out there. We've known each other since 2014. This was in Edmonton when we first met. I was part of the UARE Canada program at the University of Alberta. Were you a part of a UARE program, or were you in the MITACS program?
It was a direct collaboration of my college with Alberta. But we got to do it together because those are all part of the summer exchange programs,
yes.
Right?
Mm-hmm. Okay, so then there was multiple programs happening. There was the ones directly attached to the University of Alberta. There was the ones a part of UARE and the ones part of MITACS, which a mutual friend of ours, Ayush, was a part of. Not sure if you still talk to him, but I do follow him still on social media.
He seems to
be doing well. You do? Okay, good.
He's working for Samsung.
So everyone from who was there that summer is doing great things.
everyone that we made friends with.
Yes. Yes, the important aspect.
Exactly.
That was a great program. Actually, the first time that I left my province, even of Canada, just to do some work in terms of science and learning about what I wanted to do in the future. So I'm happy we met during that time, and luckily that we still kept in contact, still remain friends.
Yeah, that was my first time leaving my country as well. I mean, I left my province earlier than you were. So I still remember the moment when the plane landed in Vancouver. It was like, oh, wow, I'm in a different country for the first time. It's so different.
You did your bachelor's of engineering in China. You did your PhD in Duke University, which is pretty cool. Unfortunately, I was never able to visit you there, but we did meet up kind of halfway in Washington, D.C., so that was cool.
Yeah.
Been so many years, been a lot of experiences. So maybe just for the listeners, for yourself, just give them a brief overview of your experience in just academia for now. So maybe your bachelor's in China, the PhD that you did at Duke University, and maybe that'll segue into what you're currently doing now as a career.
Thank you, everyone, for listening. I started my college in China, in Beijing, in Tsinghua University, if anyone would ever know, in electronic engineering. So very hardcore engineering, as I would put it. In my third year of my college, I got the opportunity to go to University of Alberta to do a summer research assistant program. It was there that I, one, really loved the summer and the mountains, and two, I realized I wanted to do a PhD abroad after I graduated to really go deeper into science and engineering. That's why I applied. After I went back to Beijing, I applied for a few different universities in the US. And then luckily I got into Duke University in their biomedical engineering department. And then I went to Duke in 2015 and joined my group, where we do research on, the name is a little long, it's called hyperpolarized xenon MRI. So basically, MRI is magnetic resonance imaging. It's a pretty common imaging modality in the hospital, if you know. And then the special aspect we have is that we have the patient to inhale a bag of xenon gas into the lungs, and then by doing that, we're able to make images of your lungs directly, which is currently not accessible by MRI as a major modality. So it allows us to evaluate your pulmonary disease, what's going on in your lungs, which part is impaired. We have like a 3D image with pretty interesting spatial resolution to allow you to look into different corners of the lungs. So I spent 5 years there. Had publications, went to a conference abroad, everything was really well before the pandemic hit, but that was a different story. I really enjoyed my research years. I would be happy if I continued to do research, but what really made me to decide to go into consulting is that I just feel there are other options I have to, you know, try before I decide my career path, right, Kevin?
Right.
That's why I applied and eventually landed. I joined McKinsey after I graduated last year, and I've been working here for a little over half a year. That's basically a little brief background of who I am and what I did in the past few years. Yeah.
Very cool. Very cool. And yeah, I remember back when we were in Edmonton, I remember late nights and for both of us in the lab. And I remember, yeah, you were working on magnetic resonance imaging, and I'm happy that you got to continue doing that in your PhD. And is this like a fully implemented type of MRI? Like, do they do this in hospitals around the US, or is it just like an experimental thing?
Good question. It is currently not implemented as clinical tests, as part of clinical tests. Our group, along with a few other groups across the US, Canada, and UK, have a consortium to put this technology forward for clinical application. By the time I left, which was last year, we just finished a phase 3 clinical trial, and the group was preparing for FDA, you know, application. Not long from now, we'll probably see this in really assessing patients with pulmonary disease, right? It provides its unique value by really allowed to look into the lungs with spatial resolution. Yeah. So I'm very excited to see that progress.
Phase 3, that's almost at the end there.
It is almost at the end. Yeah. It's been a long journey.
No, it must be fulfilling though to realize that your work is directly influencing the outcome of some patients. So that's really cool. All right, at least in the segment before this, I talked about consulting as a different avenue towards what academics could do after their masters, after their PhDs. I kind of elaborated on how they can do that and the process to which, you know, the interview process, landing an interview, which firms that might be of interest to them. So that's all in the segment before this. And you kind of answered my next question in your intro, but maybe just to go over it again. When did you first hear about consulting? You wanted to explore different avenues. So when did you first come into contact with the idea of consulting?
For the question that when did I first hear? consulting as a career choice. That happened actually pretty early. I would say okay. It was my first year in the PhD. I knew some of the senior students were considering like a potential career path. That's why I heard consulting. At this point, I wasn't very clear what exactly consulting is doing, but what my initial impression, first impression, was that consulting works with a lot of people, in contrast to what we do in PhD, where we face computer, where we're in the lab. For me, I was just working with the MRI scanner the whole night. That's a little different, right? I mean, a lot different. Right. The second point is that they have a lot of different types of projects they work on. That's what I heard about consulting. You can help, you know, companies work on their management problems, their technological problems, and all the other types of topics are there. This is also, again, in contrast with what I focused on my research, that being 5 years of efforts of the same topic, right? So those two really gave me an interesting thought. I'd be like, I might never be able to do consulting because I wasn't trained for that. I wasn't prepared for that. It was so different from what I do, right? But that's how I learned consulting to begin with. Some people go out to do consulting after their master's, their PhDs, after their beautiful research that they have published. They eventually choose to do consulting. As I became more senior in my PhD program, I start to think of all the, you know, next steps that I could take for a PhD in engineering. I think there are three ways you can go forward. One is definitely you can, you know, continue to be a brilliant postdoc and eventually become a faculty if you want to go aggressive, right? The second one is there's always industry companies that are working on the next generation exciting tags that you can go. And the third one is consulting, which doesn't sound so like such a natural transition from what you've been doing, but they really like to take people with our background, with, you know, advanced science and technology background. That's why I started to, you know, evaluate the three other options that I had, and eventually I decided to do consulting. I mean, there are a lot of thoughts behind it.
Yeah, of course.
But my choice was between industry and consulting. Okay. And the reason I didn't really wanted to go advanced in my research was not because I didn't like it. It was just because I wanted something new, something that I can work with more. It's like human interaction, right? I want to see the value that my work creates. Research is exciting, but still, it's a long time horizon. Luckily, we see it getting applied, but oftentimes it takes a long time, even go beyond, and then it is risky whether you will see your research product getting practical value. That's why I decided to take a look at other options. And I was making decision between whether going to industry and going to consulting. And there's one experience that I had that helped me a little bit, which was that in my third year, mm-hmm. I got an internship in New York City as a, it's exciting, as a deep learning engineer. So that's deep learning, right? So it's a sexy job title for a medical imaging company. And I was fortunate enough to, you know, be part of them in the summer, working on applying deep learning, which is neural network technology, to improve their image quality. I really liked it. The only thing, I spent most of my time working in front of my computer programming. And that was fun, but there was something missing. And I always wanted to, you know, talk with different people and understand what others are thinking instead of just me, you know, crunching all my secrets, you know, all the time. So after I had a great summer there, I came back and decided, wow, let me look into this third option, which is consulting, which might help me, you know, figure out what I eventually want to do in the long term, right? Mm-hmm. That's all the thought that happened after that. And then I started to, you know, actively prepare and apply for consulting job in my fourth year. Yeah, after I did my internship in third year. Yeah, that's how the whole thing such progressed, and eventually I arrived here. Yeah, so the company actually just got a a big round of funding, and it was in the news, so it was very exciting. I was a little bit like, if I were to join them, then I'm probably doing well now. You know, a lot of choices.
But McKinsey is like the consulting place to be in. Like, if you I just Googled before we talked, best consulting company in the world, McKinsey was the first one.
We exceed in certain aspects.
Yeah. Going back to the consulting part, so when you were looking for consulting, and this is something I always ask myself when I was researching this, and even when I'm considering to do consulting after my own PhD, how much of business knowledge is a barrier to you succeeding in consulting? Is it a barrier at all?
So let me answer this question based on my experience joining the firm a little bit. I think that will help you understand this better. So McKinsey, my firm, has been recruiting PhD students for consultants, and they actually like it.
Yes.
And there are reasons, because we're smart, we know how to solve problems that no one have ever solved. Yeah, like you said, one big concern is that we actually, compared to like MBA students, we're, I would say, limited on our business. We're not that polished on business knowledge. So historically, the firm has this, we call this a mini MBA program that prepare you once you just join the firm. Basically, it will have 2 weeks of training just tailored for PhD students to really bring you up to speed with all the business knowledge. But then this program kind of got shortened and simplified when I joined. And the reason being that they did a little interesting sort of internal survey, and they found that whether you go do this training or not, your performance 1 year, 2 years later do not really differ from each other. It is definitely helpful for you to understand the context business, but even if you come in without no context, throughout the work, you naturally build your knowledge. For business knowledge, I think it's a natural process. You pick it up. So really don't need to worry about this if this is something that in the way of you pursue a consulting career. Again, I'm speaking just on behalf of what my experience is. I think there are other types of consulting which leverage more on your specific professional knowledge, right? What I'm speaking of is for management consulting that I work on based on what I feel.
Yeah, I did hear about these sorts of preparation courses that, you know, McKinsey, BCG, and Bain, yeah. They offer these preparation courses, so I'm glad you talked about that. And I would assume that the projects that you are at least given at the beginning are tailored to your experience in a way. So maybe in that sense, you're not given, you know, heavy business projects, but more focused on the experience that you provide for your team, right?
Exactly. And remember, it's always a team there, like you're part of team. So it's not just you that you have to answer all the questions, right? We work together. Business background is definitely helpful, but I want to emphasize that for us with scientific background, engineering background, it's something that we will learn naturally if you're doing the job. Yes.
So I'm really interested in the beginning part of your journey as a consultant. Why is that? Well, when I was researching consulting, what stuck in my mind was the interview process, which is very elaborate and almost like a medical school interview. Applying to consulting firms, there's a lot of techniques and tips and tricks on how to do that properly, I guess. But I guess that's for any sort of field that you want to get into. Just so I'm assuming my listeners are interested in, or the process of you becoming a consultant. So when you started applying, was it the basic, you know, you handed in your resume and a cover letter, and then when you landed an interview, maybe talk about the case interview and the fit interview to see if you're a part of their team. Maybe just talk a little briefly about that.
So the entire process, I'll briefly introduce the entire process, and we can go into each different steps. For this big consulting firms, for people like us that are students in grad school, they have cycles. They have pretty structured cycles. Usually they will start to have, you know, information sessions in the spring. Around February, March, those big firms will come to schools and host all the information sessions. They will tell you what the application process is going to be like, what the interview process is going to be like, what are the key time points for you submit your resumes and have first round interviews and second round interviews.
These are recruiting events, or?
Those are recruiting events. Yeah, recruiting events in the big in the schools. Even if there's no like official events in your schools, usually those informations are public online on their website. The resume submission deadline will be around July. Yeah, that's what I remembered. So you will have a few months before July to polish your resume and prepare for your interview. I'll go into that a little later. But then after you submit your resume, it's pretty quick. I think it took me 2 weeks-ish that they will get back to you. Whether once the deadline has hit, they'll get back to you in like 2 or 3 weeks to tell you if you have got into the first round of interview. If you do, then the interview schedule will come pretty fast as well. Usually they will tell you and then interview will happen in like 1 or 2 weeks.
Okay.
It's like back to back. And then you go to do your first round interview. They'll tell you almost that day. They'll tell you at the end of Friday, they'll tell you right away if you're in for the next one or not. If they didn't tell you that day, usually it will probably be early next week. Yeah. And then once you're in, your next round interview, which will be the second round interview, will be like 1 week after that. And then by the end of that interview, you will know whether you got the offer or not. Overall, from the end of your resume submission to your first round interview, second round interview finish, I would say it probably take a little over a month to go through the entire process. So it's like pretty tight. I would say most of the preparation should happen before you already submit your interview, right? And typically people start to prepare for it early that year for the interview process. By interview process, I mean the case interview process. I should have mentioned that there are two parts of the interviews. One is the case interview, which where you worked through a case, business case together. This is a hypothetical case where you have problems, you help to solve it. And the second part is you will share some of your background knowledge, background stories about who you are, what you did, what exciting things you have done. You need a different approaches to prepare two of them. For case interview, it is very structured. There are a lot of like tips and ways to really improve your skills by practicing with your friends. And that usually take 2 or 3 months to get ready. And for background stories, that's really about just showing who you are, right? Showing the interesting things that you have done. I believe everyone have done things that are interesting. And what the consulting firms are usually looking for there are a few things. They want to make sure that you are a team worker, a team player, right? You collaborate well with your team in the future. That's one thing. And two is you have entrepreneurship, right? You take initiatives to start things. For example, this podcast is a good initiative that you would take. Third one is that you create impact, you create value. You don't just take initiative to do boring things and the stuff that really do not really benefit anyone. You create impact, you help the community, I'll call that impact. You help people to achieve their goals, it's a great impact, right? So that's the third one. And the fourth one is that you're resilient. You work well under pressure. You know, consulting can be pretty tough. It's a tough job sometimes. So they want to make sure that you're able to withstand all this pressure that's going to be put in you in the future. So teamwork, entrepreneurship, impact, resilience. I would say these are the key elements that you want your stories to reflect those. The stories that you prepare do not have to be that, oh, I won an Olympic championship or stuff like that. It could be, it's really the way you structure it. You tell the story, we'll get a message across. So these are the two engines, but how to prepare this. A lot of people will actually put a lot more effort on the case interview and really don't put equal effort on like how to prepare their story, how to deliver it, which I think as a typical mistakes that people make, these two are very important, equally important as I would put it to prepare for interview. And then overall, I started to prepare for these two parts in May that year. And then I spent like 2 or 3 months working on those and have my interviews along the way. And by the time I got my final run, it was end of July. I finished my second run interview, got my offer. Yeah. So that's like a overall overview of the process. Happy to like dive into any of these in a more in-depth view, but this is how the whole process, I would say, one, it is very structured. Two,
yes,
it moves pretty fast, but that's how it is. It's not because it's very stressful or what. It just, it doesn't take too long to prepare, but it does need you to really, you know, watch out for other strategies to put into this. Yeah.
So let's start with the first interview, I assume, is the fit interview, correct? Where they try to decide whether you would be a good fit for the team. To me, this sounds like a standard interview where you're trying to deliver your resume in a speaking fashion. Like you're trying to tell them, I'm good because I did this, this, and this, and I have these sorts of skills from these experiences. And you try to communicate that in a, I guess, interesting and storyteller kind of way, correct?
Exactly.
Okay, so that would be the first, that would be the first interview, like a standard interview. And then what makes consulting interesting in terms of the interview process is this case interview. And I watched a lot of videos about case interviews because they really are quite interesting, especially even McKinsey on their YouTube channel. They have a couple of examples there, some case interview examples. I'm curious about if you remember what your case interview was like. Like what sort of problem did they ask you to solve with them?
I interviewed all three firms, McKinsey, BCG, and Bain. So collectively, I've gone through a lot of the cases. Some of the interesting examples, right? So I remember second run in my McKinsey interview, there was one case that they're saying a fake client, right? This is just like hypothetical. It's like a high-end Italian restaurant. And they're seeing that the revenue is declining. It's like stagnated and not going up. Usually the cases just start with this. Like you have a really broad view. Like there, when you go in, there could be a millions of different reasons that is playing here. But that's how the problem is framed. Over the course, they will show you more graphics, additional information to help you really drive through the case. And for that case, the problem that we go into zooms in from the entire restaurant to their kitchen. Somehow the problem was that their kitchen was not preparing good variety of dishes. That's why high-end Italian restaurant, that their dishes options were not like verified with abundance. And you think, oh, okay, so if there is not enough dishes, then we just make more dishes. But then there's constraints there. And the constraint, guess what? Was that their kitchenware, their knives and pans were not like optimal kind of choice of the tools that they had, like which hindered their efficiency of preparing. I mean, obviously these are all what we worked out, but I just wanted to give you like a sense of what could be the problems we arrive at. So our recommendation, like my recommendation for that case is that they switch their kitchenware to a more like structured set that will allow them to be more efficient to prepare. So that's how we moved from like a revenue decline all the way down to your kitchenware need to be changed. This is how a case interview actually went through. In order to arrive at this conclusion, we like look at their like histograms of their sales and the performance evaluation of their kitchen, and then we really brainstormed all the additional other options that you could have. And this is what we arrived. Yeah.
And so the final conclusion that you came up with to change their kitchenware, that's a completely novel idea that you arrived with based on initial information that they provided at the beginning.
Mm-hmm. Along with additional, I would say they give you some information in the beginning to like describe the problems. And then along the way, you can ask additional questions and then they will give you additional information. For example, I'll be like, I want to see how this kitchen is performing. Like, tell me what types of tools they're using, how many people are in the kitchen, like, what's the hours like, what's the shift like, and they will give you additional information. Yeah, so it's like a...
That's interesting.
It's like you probe down the road and eventually get what they're, yeah.
It's like a real-time assessment. It's almost like if I were to compare it to a med school interview, it would be like, here's a patient, diagnose this patient based on these symptoms.
Exactly. Along the way, you may need to order additional tests, right? It's like, oh, based on this, I think we need MRI scan here. And then he'll be like, oh, yeah, we actually already have an MRI scan. Here are the images.
Right.
And you'll be like, oh, then I have my next level hypothesis. Yeah. So it's very interactive, as you can tell. There will be conversations, and you work with your interviewer. And through that process, you show two sides of you. One is your capability to solve this business case as it is, right? Your critical thinking, your reasoning, creative, like problem solving. But there's on the other side, which is, how do you communicate with your interviewer? How do you present your findings? Mm. How do you react if there is stress? How do you approach it if you feel like you got lost? So those are the second parts that also is shown through the interview process that a lot of people actually don't realize when they first started.
I'm totally glad that you're tying this into communication, as this is exactly what this podcast is about.
Okay.
Normally I would have to tie it to communication somehow, but you're doing a great job with that.
Thank you. I know the script that you have, so we can cut this off. I help you bridge into your next one.
This is good. And also, just in terms of when you got your offer, for example, and I know that there are some, or I looked at some consultants who talked about the interview process and finally finding their actual position. Sometimes they negotiate their salary, sometimes they don't. I was just wondering if that ever crossed your mind, or if you ever did negotiate your salaries.
I did not negotiate my consulting offer salary for two reasons. One, okay, it actually pays pretty well already. And two, I know for these big firms, they have very strict rules to keep all the like beginners the same level, just in case, you know, people prepare and get different reactions, right? So I know it is not that easy, kind of impossible to negotiate that. But I would say for others, smaller firms, I would definitely recommend you negotiate. Especially it's a smaller company when they don't have like strict established rules. And don't worry, right, I've never heard that you lose your offer because you try to negotiate. But definitely don't put like unrealistic argument, like I want to double my salary, right? I don't think that's likely, but
yeah, I've never heard somebody lose their offer for negotiating a salary. It's just like a scary thing to do, especially if it's your first job, maybe, for example, after your studies.
Yeah. I always put like solid reason behind it, right? You need to sell yourself. It's not just like an empty ask,
right?
There are two types of reasons I see. People will say, okay, it is costly to live in the place where the job is, therefore I need more. The second type of reason is about you. What special skills do you bring to the table? How unreplaceable that you are? What values you can create for the company? And I always found the second reason works better for salary negotiation. Just really emphasize how special you are and what valuable input that you put to the company. That's always more convincing than just complain that it's more costly to live there and ask them for a raise.
Yeah, it's more deserving too. Like if there's equivalent people with this kind of similar experience that you have to tell them that you have certain assets that these people don't, and that would be kind of your argument to get a higher salary compared to these other people that you're competing against.
Yeah, exactly. And then last piece here that I always found interesting and valuable to share is that when you negotiate, it's not always just salary, right? Just remember, a lot of options are there. You negotiate salary, you negotiate your paid time off, you negotiate all the other travel bonus and free food and all that. Think of this as a comprehensive package, right? Propose something, not just salary increase, right? If you can't get that, you can always think of, can I get more paid time off? Can I get like free traveling? Think of this as a holistic thing that you want to approach. Mm-hmm. You can trade in, right? So if you can't give me salary raise, I want to ask for paid time off, other or vice versa, right? Give people options, you know?
Right.
This is part of communication effort that don't just occur to be, okay, you have to take this or not. Give them options to choose from, right? Here are three things that I want. Feel free to, you know, choose one to give to me. It will be much easier than just ask for a salary raise.
That's a good point. No one has ever really said that, at least to me. You know, negotiating is, you know, it's not just the salary. Yeah, of course. We've already talked about how great communication is for this job. And obviously, this is why I did a podcast episode on this. But specifically, I wanted to focus on now that we talked about the beginning process of being a consultant. You've had 1, 2, 3 clients already, I would imagine, and you've built relationships with them. And that, I think, is the key to success in terms of consultancy, building a network, building a kind of brand for yourself so these people can come back to you when they have other projects. And what I wrote down here is, other than delivering the highest quality of work to these clients, how do you take that extra step so that clients continue coming to you for those future projects?
I would say there are multiple levels of client relationship that you have. The first level is definitely deliver good quality work.
Right.
Give them what they ask for, what they pay you for, right? And the second level is that I would call this client intimacy, where you trust each other throughout this work. They feel comfortable around you. They will share their concerns or thoughts actively with you, right? If they have problems that were not covered in your original project, they'll let you know, right? They will seek your input, they will seek your thoughts. So that's a very important level up. And the third level, I will call it a personal bond. That's usually pretty rare, where even after your current study, you roll off, you finished it, but you still maintain connection with your client through those social media, for example, LinkedIn. Yeah, so these are the three levels. And we always strive to achieve a higher level that extend beyond the work. But understand that not everyone you will have a personal connection, but it's always great to work towards trust between the client. I think in order to achieve those next level like client relationship, there are really two components I would think are really important in our work. The first one is the mindset that you have. When we work out with our client, they're not only people that ask us to do something. They're not only just assigned as an assignment and it will work to solve it and put the result back to them. They're really part of our team. We come up with ideas along with them, and we polish whatever we have along with them. We put their thoughts and build on their ideas into deliver a final product. So throughout the process, it's not worth solving their problem by ourselves. It's while facilitating them to solve their own problems, right? And what we bring to the table are our approaches. You know, consulting firms work with so many other clients altogether. We kind of know what approaches are the best to solve certain types of problems.
Right.
That's what we offer. But the client, they know their stuff better than us. They know all the details, you know. They know all the conditional considerations. So it's really important to have both parts work together. So that's a mindset. So treat your client as part of your team, not someone that you're just going to send your result over to and call it a day, right?
Right.
So that's the mindset. The second part is the process. So you have the mindset, but also you need to watch out for what process you have. And the process basically primarily is about communication. And this boils down to many different aspects. The first one is, how do you plan to work on your project and make that plan clear to the client? Like when I do this, I will tell my client, okay, this is what we did today, and this is what the next steps will be. I'll let them know right away, and I will do whatever I say in terms of next step. And then the second one is, you should hear them actively, listening to them. Anything that they mentioned, anything that they reveal that they're concerned is, you should not only just heard it, you should hear it, but you also need to think of it and take additional action. this might sound abstract, but when you work, I'll give a concrete example. When I was presenting a framework that I built to a client mentioned that one little box that I drew in the big frameworks, he was like, oh, that box, it looks great, but there is also exceptions in our organization that oftentimes that link that you drew is not true. Like, it will be linked to additional other stuff. Like, he would mention that, but he would also say, but I think in general cases, that's correct. It's just like exceptions. So I will take note of whatever he said. Like, a week later, we had another discussion on a different content, and I brought it up. I just basically said what he told me 1 week earlier, and he might have forgot it. He was so impressed that I knew that. How did you know it? I mean, I basically, you told me, I just remembered it. I wrote it down. I took my effort to, you know, put it in my brain. So through those types of interaction, you show that you really hear what they say, you're listening to them, and you bring their concerns up. You value what they say. So these are the processes you have in your communication that really helps to build trust between you and your client. And that is the most important part. In summary, I mentioned two pieces, the mindset and the process that you take to. Yeah. So these are the key we have in working with them. I would say that for us with PhD background or master's background in science and engineering, these are the things that we usually lack. And I'm always very mindful for myself to build those. I know it's a little like, you know, in the air, but really... Glad you're part of your team and listen to them.
So the overview you gave sounds like it's a team effort. One of the key aspects is to listen to your client. Like, they have a lot of things going on in their head. They probably have a solution in their head, but they just have so much going on that they need somebody to help organize and clear that mess that they have. A consultant is somebody who kind of helps them in that.
Right, and a lot of problems are solved that way. I mean, there are the other types of studies, a project, how to solve problems, but what you just said, to help them organize their thought, to surface the idea that will work to solve their problem from within the organization is actually a big approach, like an important approach that we take to solve problems. And oftentimes our client got trapped because there's just so many things going on. There are too many things in their head. They don't know which one to advance with.
And just like a final thing about with COVID relationships now, has these internet calls and these internet Zoom call consultations, has that impacted your work a lot, or it's not much of a change?
To put it two ways, yes, it has impacted a lot. And two, we have got used to it. impact a lot. Certainly were, for example, I stay in my place all day now. I don't really see either my teammates or clients face-to-face anymore. Like, having Zoom meetings all day generates the Zoom fatigue, right? You're staring your screen, you talk to your screen all the time. Right. There are definitely additional challenges, but we have worked other ways to overcome this. We were more mindful for each other's time over Zoom. We try to do less just those face-to-face Zoom meetings if possible, make us available to our teammates or clients however possible, you know, taking care of each other, not only just work, but also like mental health, personal boundaries, all that, to make sure that you have a sustainable, right, work-life balance when things gets hard. Yeah, that got hard. Yeah, so I'm looking forward to when we come back, we go back to start to traveling when things, you know, start to be more reasonable. But right now, yes, at home. Most of them.
Which makes me more happy that you accepted to do this. I know it's another like Zoom sort of call for you, but
I'm just so used to this. This is what I do all day now. It's just another Zoom call.
Another Zoom call, yeah. So I sent this to Z before our talk today, but just to reiterate now, so in adult life, whenever you need advice, you ask professionals like yourself and a consultant because they have such high expertise in what they do. And during adolescence, you ask your close circle. So, you know, your parents, guardians, siblings, even close friends, for example. So my question to you before the interview was, when you were a child or when you were young, who did you go to when you needed advice, and what was the best piece of advice they gave you?
This is an interesting question. I would say I definitely had someone to give me advice, except for my parents, but usually those are not best practice advice that I received. There should be better practice advice, but I'll tell you that I have this close friend that lived like next door. It's like in the same neighborhood, who happens to be a few months older. I would say half a year older. I was pretty quiet and introverted when I was young, and he was like the more extroverted person. So I always went to him when I have like want to do something, or like, oh, something bad has happened, how do I cover it? Right. And he will always say things that should not be the good practice. I was like, I remember there was a time I saw like some orange trees on my way back home along the street. Okay. You know, I'm from like a town in the mountains in China. I grew up, it wasn't like structured like any neighborhood here. You had farms along the way, and like orange farm trees, and I just the other day I saw like an orange tree, really good oranges. I was like, oh, I want to have oranges. And I just brought it up with my friend. He was like, why don't you go and steal some? Oh, I was like, then we'll get this, like, what if we got caught? So he like, oh, let's work a plan out to you know, make sure you don't get caught.
Scheme.
We'll generate some smoke, or we work out a really good plan, like how, what we do, who will be watch out for people, who will do the actions and all that. And eventually I got the oranges and brought to my parents. I stole some oranges and some are for you.
At least you got some for other people.
Yeah, exactly. Exactly.
The balance. Exactly.
It didn't really go well, but see, that's how I seek advice from people that are slightly older than me, and I knew they will have more experience on certain aspects of things. I say that because I can always relate this to my work in consulting firm. We really emphasize this model called apprenticeship, which is people that are slightly more senior than you really coach you and help you develop the skills you need. Like when I first started, I would work with people that are like 1 year experience, and they should tell me how to make slides, how to do Excel sheet, how to write emails properly. As I advance a little more, I start to work with like early managers who has like 2 years experience and more. So this is how I believe a lot of consulting firms like that. You learn, you work closely with people and you learn directly from them, and you pass along the way of working, the approach that you saw problems down as you become more senior. So that's something actually I really liked it about. It's you learn so much as you go up, and there is always mentor and people that help you out along the way. That's something I really enjoyed. It might be the best practice, but in a professional setting, it is how you make progress. Yes.
So you went from stealing oranges to helping Italian restaurants. So
that's just an example.
That's a good thing. That's a good thing.
I never talk about like what I do right now. I've been working on healthcare industry. Okay. I've helped pharmaceutical companies, helped hospitals, you know, develop their quality management systems, helped hospitals try to transform some of their process to, you know, cut their over expensing items in their operation. Yeah, that's what I've been doing.
And I assume it's quite busy now because of the whole pandemic happening. So,
yes. Interestingly, we have a lot of studies, and we're hiring more people. So, I think overall consulting field is thriving and expanding. So, don't hesitate to join us if this is something that you're interested in. Yeah.
And that's McKinsey, right? And you work at the Atlanta.
Office.
Atlanta office. I didn't realize there was a Dublin office. So as I was doing research on this, there's an office down here.
Yeah, go for a visit.
I'll do some tourist pictures near there and send it to you.
Let me know.
Yeah, so that's really all the questions I had for ZE here. Normally, I end these interviews off with just some final thoughts that you have about consulting, about the process of graduate students going into consulting, sort of communication aspects of consulting. Just some final thoughts and some self-promotion of groups like McKinsey or other groups that you're a part of that you'd like to shout out.
I think I don't represent McKinsey here. I just, you know, share my own thought. Whatever I share is all like my own feelings, you know. Yeah. And in terms of the final thought, there are many thoughts that I have and I would like to share. But this is one thing that I've been thinking of since I joined the firm, especially whenever I feel the job is so hard. It's so different from PhDs, and sometimes I work long hours. But this final thought is that it's really when I put myself out my comfortable zone that I make progress, that I become more skillful, that I learn new skills, that I work better. And I think consulting is this platform that allows you to constantly do that. You will constantly be put into something you've probably never done before, that you're not good at, but then you strive to do it again and then improve. And that's what I think really valuable when I look back on my half a year experience here. I've had a lot of client meetings, I've had difficult moments, I've had deadlines that I like just can't meet. But eventually I've gone through all of that I think I emerged to be a better person. And I've done something great for the client so that in the end, it's like all these opportunities you get to challenge yourself. Yeah, how you go forward, right? That's what I want to emphasize. And a lot more to come.
good. But yeah, okay. So that's it. Thanks, ZE, for coming on the podcast. Another Zoom call for you, but it was super fun. And your knowledge and insight in the consulting space is something that, you know, a lot of my listeners will love, and I myself love. It's definitely knowledge that I needed to know when I'm exploring different avenues that I have for when I finish my PhD. So thanks again.
You're welcome. I'm glad you liked it. Feel free to reach out to me if you have another questions or follow-up questions.
If people wanted to reach out to you about questions, how could they do that? Best do that?
Yeah, I track my LinkedIn pretty often. Feel free to reach out to me and say you got to this through this podcast, and I will try my best to help address whatever you have.
Okay, so I'll put your LinkedIn in the podcast description.
Yep.
Cool.
Thank you for listening to this episode of the Metaforgeons podcast. As another quick update, unfortunately, I've recorded this quite early on, so there's not too much new happening. I've been in the lab shadowing some amazingly talented researchers on their techniques, so excited to apply what they've shown soon. More updates will be given via bits and pieces throughout the season, so stay tuned, and hope you enjoy this great chapter of life. Remember to follow the Instagram page for these visual updates, as well as to be entered into the draw for the custom butterfly-printed Metaforgeon shirt, which will be given out on the 30th episode. Until then, stay skeptical, but curious.